Seems sad to imagine you giving in and making music like everyone else's." Da looked almost startled.
"I'm just trying to be open to other ideas, honey. I couldn't play with those guys if I close off into my own little Zen dream and not see what's happening around me."
"You've never been closed off, Da. Never," I said fiercely. "But if you just open yourself up to anything that comes along, just for the sake of having some new experiences, it's the same as taking drugs for some new sensation. And maybe things you don't want can get into you if you leave yourself open. Bad stuff."
"Bad ideas?" Jesse said, his eyes and mind too sharp. "That's pretty serious stuff, Alley Cat," Da said. But I could tell from his smell that he was thinking of what I had said.
With a flash of wonder, it came to me that fighting the sickness might only be a matter of this, of resisting the dark vision that the world seemed so constantly to be offering itself and embracing as truth. The inner door opened, and Serenity came into the kitchen, carrying a tray upon which rested the remnants of a sandwich. As usual, the shredded food could probably be put together into a whole meal. She looked pale and exhausted in her drab black clothes.
Da got up, looking concerned. "Zambia mustn't make you sit for such long stretches."
"I don't care," Serenity said, flatly. Da lifted his hand to her cheek, and she slapped it away. The sound of the slap echoed in the kitchen, shocking us all into immobility. Then Serenity seemed to shrink in on herself.
I'm sorry," she stammered. She backed to the door and turned to rush out, letting it bang behind her. "What is it about you women that you meet any crisis by running out and slamming the door?" Jesse asked with asperity.
I glared at him indignantly, though my mind was on Serenity. I looked at Da, and for a moment he looked old and tired. Terror clutched at me, but he caught my gaze and smiled.
"The truth is that I was thinking of Serenity when these young men were talking and playing tonight. I was thinking that if I could understand their anger, it would give me a key to unlock Serenity, to find a way to relate to how she feels." "I don't think even Serenity can relate to how she feels," Jesse said.
The next day, Serenity caught the early bus to school, and I did as well, having set the alarm to make sure I was up in time. It was early enough that once I had seen her go into the school, I was able to double back out of the yard and call the newspaper office. I didn't expect Gary Solomon to be in, and I had written out a message for the receptionist to leave, but she insisted on putting me through to his voicemail. I hate leaving recorded messages, so I just read out my note, asking that he meet me in the mall at the Quick Brown Fox tonight between 5 and 6, so that we could talk about matters of mutual interest. I felt a bit pompous saying those last words, but I hadn't wanted to be specific. The time I had given him was when Serenity would be with Mum in the studio for at least a couple of hours. Keeping tabs on her at lunchtime and recess was no small feat, and I had little time to talk to Jilly. She would have come with me, but that would have made us too conspicuous. The one good thing about tracking Serenity was that it brought me face to face with Cole at a moment when I knew that Harlan was on the sports field with the school rugby team. "Hi, Cole," I said, stopping him with a bright smile. "Listen, I was just wondering if you've always lived here."
"I have," he said, looking puzzled. "Why?"
I mugged disappointment. "Oh, I'm just doing this project, and I need to interview someone who used to live somewhere else. Someone said you used to live in Shale Town." There was no mistaking his reaction. He paled and looked sick. But at the same time, he seemed to brace himself. "I never lived there," he said.
"Oh, damn," I said lightly. "Do you know anyone who did?"
"Live in Shale Town?" The faintest hesitation, but again, unmistakable. It was as if he disliked saying the word.
"Not just there," I said airily. "Anywhere other than here. It wouldn't have to have been for long, but it has to be living there, not just visiting or holidaying."
I was babbling, wanting to allay any suspicions, wanting to get away from the mention of Shale Town. "I know that Paolo Caris lived somewhere else before here, and so did Meredith Labors. You could try them. Hetty Ransom lived in China with her parents, too. She's that kid with the really thick glasses."
"Paolo, Meredith, and Hetty Ransom," I muttered, as if I were fixing the names in my memory. I thanked him, and at the same time, I reached out and lightly tapped his hand. Then I walked away without looking back. My heart was hammering from the jolt of electricity I had got from the touch, but I had been expecting it, so it shook me a lot less than the accidental touches. I had been wanting to know something in particular, and for a second I had got a flash of something. Cole, standing on a white sandy road, blazing with reflected sunlight, except where the blocky shadow of a building fell over it. Some long grass by the road, shimmering in the heat. Not enough to guess where it was, but enough to tell me that it was a place Cole had been, which he associated with Harlan Sanderson. Next period, I was separated from Jilly by one of those teachers who seemed to think close friendship in class is a bad thing, and made to sit next to Marilyn Bloom. I would have been annoyed, except I suddenly remembered that she had a younger brother called Carl, who was in the same year level as Cole. On impulse, I asked if she knew him. "He came round a couple of times," she said. "He was a bit of a desperado, I thought, and so did Carl. He was a hanger-on type who'd do anything to belong. You couldn't like him, no matter how slavishly he tried to please you. I don't think the teachers liked him any better than the kids, even though his aunt's a teacher here." "His aunt, Mrs. Barker," Marilyn said. "His sister's Cole's mother." I stared at her. Could what had happened between Cole and Harlan be the reason that Mrs. Barker had acted so strangely about Harlan? Then I registered what she had said. "You said Cole used to be like that, so he's not like that now." Marilyn shook her head. "I remember Carl talking about it. He said Cole's different. He became a loner." On the way to the second last class, I couldn't tell Jilly about Cole because Marilyn Bloom walked over with us. Then after class, I had to head off home straight away because Serenity got on the first bus. I left Jilly, knowing that she was meeting Harrison to point Harlan out. I felt a stab of stupid jealousy at the thought of them following him together and then maybe sitting and talking afterwards over hot chocolates. Then I remembered Jilly was crazy about Raoul. I sighed, wishing I would get over what was rapidly becoming a major crush on Harrison. What was the point in carrying a torch for someone who saw you as a friend and who regarded his feelings when he kissed you as nothing more than a general physical reaction to any female? Despite my liking for Harrison, I realized that I didn't like what he had said. It seemed uncharacteristically careless somehow. "Stop thinking about him," I ordered myself, and turned my thoughts to Gary Solomon and the meeting I had arranged. Once Serenity was in with Mum, I changed out of my uniform, shoved some homework into a shoulder bag, and set off, calling out to Jessie that I was going to the IMAX at the mall. If Gary Solomon didn't come, and it was a definite possibility, I would have something to drink in the Quick Brown Fox and do my homework before heading home. I reached the mall at 5:10, and 20 minutes later, Gary Solomon strode in, frowning. I had been careful not to look like a schoolgirl this time, and I was glad I had taken the trouble when his eyes first skated over me and then swung back, widening. But when he sat down in the booth, he emanated annoyed impatience. "All right, what is it? I don't have time for these sorts of games," he said. I lost my temper a little. "Fine, then I won't take too much of your valuable time. I just wanted you to know that I'm investigating Aaron Race with my friends, and we have found out some things you might like to know. I haven't mentioned you to my friends because I promised not to, but I want to suggest we give you what we've learned, so I have to tell them about you. That means breaking my promise." His expression tightened as I spoke. "Alizon, I warned you to be careful." "I have been careful," I said firmly. "We have." "Who is we?" Two could play the secrecy game. I looked into his eyes, smiled, and said, "That's none of your business." He smiled too, briefly. "Well, you are discreet, I'll give you that. And you keep your word. Look, I'm sorry I was so sharp just now. It's just that it was a hell of a job to get here, and I was afraid that you were going to tell me that... Well, anyway, what have you found out?"
"I can't tell you until I talk to the others."
"Can't or won't?" he asked, offering me his handsome prince smile. "Won't," I said coolly. He went in a second from flashing anger to amusement. Then he shook his head. "All right, you can tell them. When will you talk to me?"
I considered for a moment. "Next week, maybe."
After Roel had been to the Orba function, and after Daisy finds out what she can about Race, Inc. Despite his avowal that he didn't have time to spare for such meetings, The journalists spent another 20 minutes trying to talk me into giving something away. Then he switched tack and began asking me about myself and my life and my interests. He was being so nice and smooth and friendly that alarm bells rang, and I thought of a film I had seen a while back. "You can't romance it out of me," I said bluntly. For a moment he looked astounded, then he burst out laughing. His eyes were so admiring that I flushed with pleasure in spite of myself. He offered me a lift home, but I said I'd call my brother. The truth was, I wanted a few quiet moments to think before I headed home. 10 minutes later, I rose and turned to leave, and was shocked to find myself face to face with Harlan Sanderson.
Harlan, I stammered, sounding horribly guilty. What are you doing here?
He smiled coldly.
Looking for you, not at the movies, but here.
He must have called the house, and Jesse had told him that I was going to the IMAX. I prayed that he hadn't seen Gary Solomon go out, because he had been with the class when we visited the newspaper office. He would certainly remember that Gary was an investigative journalist, and even if he didn't connect it with his own activities, he might wonder why I was meeting him after saying I was going to the movies. I had an inspiration. I told them at home I was going out to the movies, but the truth is I needed some time out. My sister is acting so crazy these days, you wouldn't believe it. You know her, don't you? You gave me that green flash drive for her.
I was just passing it on,
Harlan said lightly, but his thick, rotting smell deepened and became infinitely more horrible. I swallowed hard, because the faint scent of violets and licorice had been mixed up in that dreadful stink, which meant he knew exactly who Serenity was. I wished I dared reach out and touch him, but even the thought of it made my danger sense scream.
You want to go for a walk? Harlan invited.
I didn't need any warning from my danger sense to refuse.
Oh, I've just called Jesse to come and get me, I lied.
So, Harlan said, leaning across the table, any news on who taught Jilly's place?
Fury clawed at me that he could mention it so casually when the smell of smoke and petrol wound so revealingly through his awful smell. But I held his gaze guilelessly and shrugged. I think the police are putting it down to vandalism.
Useless bastards, the cops, Harlan said pleasantly. So, what about the drive-in?
I still have to pin down Da, I said.
You're Da, Harlan mocked. Well, okay, let's go ask him now. I'd like to meet the famous McColl White Star.
How do you know his name? I asked.
Everyone knows his band outdid Urban Dingo, Harlan said easily.
He had given me an opening, and without thinking, I took it. It's funny you should mention the gig, because ever since that Urban Dingo gig, Da has been getting a lot of work through this guy called Aaron Race. Harlan's smell altered, but rather than becoming darker and stronger, I had the weird impression that it drew back and faded. Then my danger sense began to scream, and I had the utterly strange and dreadful impression that something dark and ancient was looking at me out of Harlan's eyes. I clamped on my senses to stop myself giving way to screaming hysterics and bent to suck childishly and loudly at the froth in the bottom of the long glass. Harlan got jerkily to his feet and said he had to go. His eyes were like fogged green pebbles. He sketched a stiff, unnatural-looking wave and went out. I stayed sitting there until my legs recovered. Then I did call Jesse. Maybe I had sounded odd, because when he arrived, he asked if I was okay. It was only after I got home that I cursed myself for not having called Harrison from the mall when I had the chance, because I arrived right on dinner time when the kitchen was full of people and activity, and there was no possibility of making a private call. I ate the veggie moussaka distractedly, sitting between Miranda, who ate with tears trickling down her cheeks, and Serenity, who sat dissecting her meal in stony silence. It was lucky that Da and Jesse were talking intensely about music, or there would have been dead silence at the table. The only time my ears pricked up was when Da reminded Serenity that she had a dentist appointment straight after school the next day. He said he would collect her with Mum and Luke, and they would all visit the dentist on the way to look at Mum's new gallery. His voice was light and friendly, but I saw how he watched her, and I smelled the ammonia sharpness of his concern for her. Then Mum called down to Serenity, her voice croaky with weariness, as it always was when she stopped being nocturnal for a while. I escaped upstairs as soon as Serenity had gone up, taking Luke with me, and playing with him on my bed, until Dar came and got him for a bath. Then I went down to the kitchen to call, but Miranda was sitting by the phone, staring at it pitifully. I sighed and went back upstairs and did some homework. I woke when Serenity came into the bedroom and realized with chagrin that I had fallen asleep and it was now too late to call anyone. I went to clean my teeth, feeling frustrated and impatient. Jesse poked his head round the bathroom door and said apologetically that he had forgotten to tell me, but there had been two calls for me while I was out. "Jesse," I groaned in annoyance. "It's too late to call Jilly back now." But Jesse shook his head. "The calls were both from guys. Two different guys," he added on a teasing note. "The first was Harlan something, and the second guy, well, his name was sort of similar." "Next time, write a note," I sighed. So Harlan had called home, as I had guessed. And the second call must have come from Harrison. He must have wanted to tell me something about following Harlan. I would ring him back first thing in the morning to tell him about Gary Solomon and also to tell him that Harlan had sought me out. I hadn't been in bed more than half an hour when Dark came in to say Harrison was on the phone. Feeling a strong sense of déjà vu, I dragged on my dressing gown and went down to the kitchen where Neil and Titch were eating doughnuts and drinking coffee. It was almost midnight.
"Allison!"
Harrison almost shouted. "Is something wrong?" I could feel Titch and Neil listening and struggled to keep my voice low and calm.
"Is something wrong?" Harrison growled, his accent strong. "Christ, Allison, you scared me half to death. I called hours and hours ago, and your brother tells me you'd gone out to meet Harlan Sanderson, and you didn't call back."
"Oh, Harrison, Jesse forgot to say you'd called, and I wasn't meeting Harlan. I had gone to the mall, and he had called here and found out where I was going. We only talked for about 10 minutes in a coffee shop, and then he left. What did he want?"
"Same thing as usual," I said carefully.
"Someone's there," Harrison guessed. "Of course. Maybe we could meet tomorrow." There was a ragged pause. Then Harrison said, "All right, I could come at lunchtime." I shook my head, then realized he couldn't see. "Tomorrow after school will be fine."
"What about your sister?"
"That's fine," I said guardedly.
"All right, I don't get it, but I get it. After school it is. You can come with me to Raoul's. I made some recordings of Sari talking about the sickness ages back, and Raoul wants to listen to them again."
I agreed, then rang off to find Titch and Neil looking at me sympathetically.
"Boyfriend problems?" Titch asked.
"Of course not," I said, feeling myself blush annoyingly. "He's just a friend."
"A pretty good friend, if he called this late to ask about another man," Neil said, grinning coyly at me.
Despite everything, I couldn't help smiling.
"There, that didn't hurt, did it?" he said. "Despite what the world says, love is a laughing matter."
"I'm not in love," I laughed.
"Laughter is the best medicine," Titch said wisely, and that broke Neil up.
Titch regarded him with wounded amusement.
"I read that in the Reader's Digest."
That made Neil nearly convulse with laughter. His big belly wobbled like jelly. Dark came in carrying some music and looked at us all in puzzlement, which made it even funnier. On the way up the stairs, a few minutes later, it struck me that it had been ages since I laughed so hard. I noticed how light it had made me feel for a moment. But when I was back in bed, wakeful now, my smile faded at the memory of the conversation with Harlan, the queer certainty that, for a second, the sickness he carried had been fully awake and fully aware because I had mentioned the name of Aaron Race. 38. At breakfast the next morning, Miranda was in mourning mode, no longer weeping but staring at her Weet-Bix in abject despair. I noticed her greasy-looking hair and bitten nails and decided the fight with Ricky must have been more serious than usual. Normally, she didn't let her emotional storms affect how she looked. I tried to ask her what had happened, but she seemed not to hear me. I might have tried again on the way to school, but Serenity was ready for the early bus, so I had to follow her. I had remembered to bundle Harrison's coat into a carrier bag to return it that night, so it was thumping awkwardly against my legs as I came through the garden. Dad was weeding the vegetable patch as we passed through, and he called out to Serenity not to forget the dentist appointment. She nodded without looking at him and marched down the street, her black trench coat flapping like the wings of some draggled black bird. Seeing the worry in Dar's face, I stopped to say goodbye properly, then remembered to tell him I might be late home for dinner because of meeting with Harrison. He gave me a look that made me aware Titch and Neil had probably confided their romantic theories to him, but he said nothing. I had reached the gate before I remembered something else and turned back to suggest that maybe Miranda was going to need a lift, because at the rate she was moving, she would miss the next bus as well.
"She does seem to be taking this harder than usual," Dar said thoughtfully. "Maybe a long weekend would do her good. On the other hand, if she goes to school, she'll be forced to think about something other than her troubles. Pity she didn't have a band rehearsal. It's amazing how that can lift you out of yourself."
I smiled at him, loving his certainty that music could solve all the ills of the world. And then I sobered and almost hurried after my storm crow of a sister who was almost out of sight. At the bus stop, Serenity didn't look at me, and on the bus she sat as far from me as she could. Getting off, I noted that the sun was shining and the day full of birdsong. It seemed like I hadn't noticed the sky or the gardens for weeks. I followed Serenity inside the library, and I watched until I saw her open a notebook and start writing. Only then did I go back outside, because it was still early enough to take a walk around the oval before class began. I set off briskly, remembering the pleasure I had taken in walks right after the accident. When the holidays came, I promised myself I would start walking again. Then I realized I couldn't do anything until Serenity was safe, and that undid the good the walk had done. But I cheered up when Jilly appeared just before the bell, even though there was no time to talk. I had been worried she might be nervous about meeting Harlan, but she smelled of the sea and the sun and warm sand, and I knew she was okay. Despite my increasing feeling that school was irrelevant, I was glad to be plunged into a day that turned out to be full and demanding, even if half of it was taken up with making notes for holiday homework. Jilly told me at recess that she and her gran were going house hunting again that night, and that there were two houses which sounded promising. She said they were both sick to death of living in a hotel and eating in the restaurant or ordering room service. I told her about Harlan finding me in the mall, and her eyes widened in alarm. "Do you think Harlan will tell Aaron Race you mentioned him?" Jilly asked. "Maybe, but it came up naturally enough, and it was worth the risk to see how Harlan reacted." At the end of the day, I hung around after class, helping to tidy up, because I had the feeling Harlan would be waiting to find out if I had asked Dar about the drive-in. When I judged that enough time had passed for it to be safe, I slipped out the side door and made my way through the back streets to meet Harrison at the same cafe we had sat in when I told him the truth about myself. We had planned to meet inside in case of rain, but the sun was shining and he was waiting outside, leaning against the wall. He had a complicated expression of sadness mingled with resignation on his face before he noticed me, and I wondered if he was thinking of his father. Then I called his name, and he swung around and smiled. "I'm sorry about worrying you last night," I said, handing him the bag with his coat in it. He took it, and we headed back to the bus stop.
"What happened with Harlan anyway?" he asked. "Tell me the whole thing."
I hesitated, then asked if he'd mind if I waited until we were with Raoul, because I had already told it once to Jilly that day.
"Okay," he said. "So, who was listening last night?"
Some reckless daring prompted me to say lightly, "A couple of Dad's muso friends. They thought you must be in love with me because you were calling so late." Harrison gave a strangled laugh that sounded both alarmed and embarrassed. All at once, desperate to shift the subject before he said something that would cut me to the quick, I asked if there was something wrong with his father. Harrison lifted his eyes to the sky and gave a sort of muted Tarzan cry. I gaped at him in astonishment, and he looked down at me and burst into laughter.
"I'm not going mad," he said when he had got control of himself.
It's just that... Ah, hell, I might as well tell you. My father is an alcoholic. That's what I meant when I told you before that he tries to hide from things. He's a binger. That means a lot of the time he's fine, and he doesn't drink at all. But about once a fortnight he goes on a bender and drinks till he falls down wherever he is. Then he wakes and drinks again. When the binge is over, he somehow gets himself home. Last night was the first night he'd been home for 3 days, and he was a mess. I had to clean him up, and at the same time I was worrying about what had happened to you.
Oh, Harrison, I said, full of pity. Can't he get help?
There's not really anything anyone can do, Harrison said. He's a pretty good father when he's okay. But we tried to keep the bingers to ourselves, because otherwise the welfare would be on to us, and there would go all of my freedom.
I didn't know, I said softly.
He shrugged. How could you? You can do a lot, but you cannot read minds, thank God.
He said this so harshly, it jarred me. He gave me a quick look.
I didn't mean that how it sounded. It's just that I wouldn't want anyone reading my thoughts.
When we got on the bus, we were both silent. I was thinking about how it must feel to have to take care of your father instead of the other way round. Once, I looked at Harrison out the corner of my eye, but his expression was intensely private and gave away nothing of his thoughts.
Hello, Raoul greeted us, looking pleased. You're just in time to try some of this chocolate I've made. They serve it like this in Italy, and it's made with melted chocolate instead of powder. I've got some croissants from the bakery in honour of it.
So there we were, half an hour later, eating croissants and drinking hot chocolate that was the most delicious thing I'd ever drunk in my life. But then Raoul asked what had been happening, and Harrison turned to me expectantly. So I set the cup aside and told them what had happened with Harlan. I expected them to reproach me for the risks I had taken, but Raoul said he thought my extended senses would keep me from doing anything that would endanger me.
You say you felt this virus was looking at you out of Harlan's eyes, like it was alive.
Maybe not alive exactly, I said, just roused.
It could be, Raoul said thoughtfully. In a way, every cell in our body is a separate life form, with its own motivations. Look at the compulsion of white and red blood cells. Both have their own job to perform. When things get out of kilter, one can begin to devour the other. It may be that this virus is simply following the same sort of inbuilt motivations, and one of them responded to the sense you gave off, or to some other clue outside the range of normal human perceptions, when you spoke Aaron Race's name.
Raoul absently poured more chocolate as I told them about Cole, and they both looked interested when I described the brief vision I had experienced.
It sounds a lot like he was thinking about where he was when whatever it was went wrong between him and Harlan, and if you're right about what it was, then there's a good chance you saw the place where the infections happen, Raoul said. It's a great pity the vision wasn't clearer.
Harrison drew in a deep breath.
It's a long shot, but when you talked about what you saw, Alison, it made me think of those warehouses on the industrial estate in Shaletown. Remember the ones owned by Race's wife? There was long grass by the side of the road, and if it was not raining, that sandy surface could look white, and a warehouse would cast a blocky shadow.
It's worth taking a look, Raoul said. Then he got a strange look on his face, and he said in a queer, arrested voice,
Do you know something? It's an odd thing, but my car is playing up.
We could take a train there this weekend and have a look around, Harrison began.
You don't understand, Raoul said. That young guy we gave a lift to the industrial estate, he said that something in my car would break and it would give me a reason to come back. Something like that. Just like he knew we would need one.
Harrison nodded, frowning.
I remember. He said he would get a new one for when it broke, but it could just be that he's a good mechanic.
The hair was rising on the back of my neck as I told them what Davy had said to me.
You ken what this means. He mun be able to see or sense people who are infected too, Harrison said, his accent strong with excitement. That has to be what he means by them and they. And I've just thought of something else. Remember how he said he'd got to show us the way, and it sounded like he'd got his tenses muddled. But what if he meant exactly what he said? That he was showing us the way to them.
to the place where the gang meets and where the infections happen, the warehouses. Oh, you can what this means, he added, almost shouting as he remembered.
I do, Raoul said softly, but I wonder if you do.
What do you mean? Harrison asked, frowning.
I mean, we are talking about rather more than extended senses, if Davy really was directing us to them. Because how did he know he was supposed to direct us? Who told him? And if no one told him, then how does he know? And how did he know my car would need repairing? He couldn't, unless he can see into the future. Now it was my turn to gape, until another memory slipped into my mind. Davy, looking at Harrison, checking his watch, and saying he had to go home, and that he wouldn't get wet, despite the rain, as if he had known he would be driven there in Raoul's car. I told the others, and my voice sounded different to my ears, as if it were being reshaped by the strangeness of what it was expressing. Then I thought of the dream I had remembered moments before Sari's attack. Davy with me at the detention center, but in the dream he hadn't seemed simple at all.
I can smell the wrongness, he had said. You can smell it too, can't you?
No, I had told him.
Yes, you can. You smell it in people. The wrongness is inside them, making them sick and bad.
What are you remembering now? Raoul asked.
The question dragged me into the present, and I told them about the dream. That's how I came to be talking to Sari about wrongness. Something she said reminded me of the dream, and I asked if she thought people could visit you in your dreams.
You think Davy came to you in a dream?
No, I mean, well, I don't know.
He is part of this somehow, Raoul said, and I believe he knows we will see him again, and why. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to drive to Shale Town and find out what he knows, and I'm going to take another look at those warehouses.
You ken what I think, Harrison said, looking from Raoul to me, a queer expression on his face. I think both you and Davy are a natural response to this sickness. If we think of humanity as an organism, which of course it is, like any species, it stands to reason there'd be a response to an attack.
A response by whom? God? I asked.
By the organism as a whole. Just like each individual body produces antibodies when a dangerous organism invades.
You're saying we're some sort of antibodies? I was glad to laugh at the absurdity, because I had begun to feel a little like we were floating off into the ether.
But Harrison said, quite seriously,
in a metaphysical sense, yes, that's exactly what I think.
The telephone rang, and Raoul went to answer it. He came back looking worried.
That was the matron of Bellevue. Dr. Austin has been on the phone, demanding to know by whose authority Sari was removed from his care. Luckily for Sari, Dr. Austin upset the matron, because otherwise she would never have called me, and I wouldn't know he's planning to go to Remington.
He mustn't be allowed near her, I said, appalled.
My sentiments exactly. The trouble is that, as her previous doctor on record, he does have some authority. I've just called the doctor who's been caring for Sari at Bellevue. It's her day off, but she has agreed to come in when Dr. Austin arrives. She wants me to meet her at the hospital.
We'll go too, Harrison said, half rising, but Raoul shook his head.
I need you to stay here and wait for my hacker friend, Daisy. She's going to come this evening, and I don't want to spend the time right now tracking her down and going through all her mazes to get to her and put her off. Can you stay on to meet her?
I can, Harrison said, glancing at me.
Me too. At least I can stay until the last bus.
Don't worry about the bus. I'll be back in time to drive you home, Raoul promised. Help yourself to anything you want, and use the computers or TV or whatever. Call for takeaway if you're hungry. There are some numbers by the phone.
Okay, Harrison said. But are you sure?
I'm sure I want you to be here for Daisy. She's not the sort to take kindly to being stood up, even by a cripple who can't stand. I'll leave a note for you to give her.
I didn't like this, Harrison said, after he had gone.
Me either, I said. Why would Dr. Austin go all that way to see Sari?
The sickness must be driving him. But dinna worry, Raoul will ne'er let him lay a hand on her.
Harrison suggested we pass the time by going through the articles that referred to Aaron Race and making lists
of all the artists he'd been associated with, because sooner or later we ought to try to find out which, if any, were infected. We had only been logged onto the lounge computer for 20 minutes when the doorbell rang. Harrison went to answer it and ushered in a scraggy old woman of about 60, clad in skin-tight leather jeans and jacket, a white T-shirt and black boots with high stiletto heels. She had the foulest mouth I had ever heard on someone old enough to be a grandmother. She was Raoul's hacker friend Daisy, of course, and she was furious to hear she had just missed him. We barely managed to stop her walking away then and there, but she calmed down when she read Raoul's note. She shoved it in her pocket, looked from me to Harrison, and then swore some more about being left to deal with the kindergarten. Harrison looked as if he was about to say something, but I just asked her sweetly if she wanted to see the computer room. "You think I need directions, kid?" she snarled, and stalked past me into the hall and down the back of the house. "We need her," I hissed at Harrison, before hurrying after her. By the time I got into the back room, she was already at a terminal, tapping away. 10 minutes later, she shifted to the next terminal, and then to the next, tapping and huffing and swearing constantly. Now that her attention was not riveted on me, I was able to study her properly. And the strange thing was that in spite of her language and grumpy rudeness, my senses warmed to her jasmine and bubblegum scent. In reality, however, she smelled of smoke and sweat. She had set a packet of cigarettes on the desk beside her, but she made no attempt to light one the whole time she was there. "You Elizon?" she asked, glancing over her shoulder. Her hands continued flying over the keyboard. "Yes," I said, realizing Raoul must have written about us in the note. She made no comment about my name and went on tapping until Harrison came in. Then she gave him the same interrogating glare. "You're Harrison." "Yes," Harrison said, looking startled. She shot him another acerbic look. "Don't sound too sure, kid. Got to be sure who you are in this world or someone will steal your identity." I didn't know if she was joking or not, and from the look on his face, neither did Harrison. "Can you fix the virus?" he asked her. Daisy gave him a withering look. Then she said, "It's an interesting breed, designed to form spontaneous links to heavy porn sites, and it can circumvent the sort of bars people use to stop their kids viewing stuff like this. Lucky Roo has such a sophisticated setup, because a normal system wouldn't let me track the originating site." She tapped for a bit more as we waited with bated breath. Then she let out a hiss of air between clenched teeth. "You found it?" She nodded absently. "Castledine Estate website." But that's the website Raoul logged into when..." "There's a false loop of trails that would bamboozle a lesser hacker, but I can tell you that the virus originated at that site," Daisy said. And she gave a small smile and stretched with the languid sensuality of a cat, all the skinny stiffness in her smoothed and fluid with triumph. Then she shot us a look and said, "And this site is linked to the Race Incorporated site that Rue asked me to check out. Doesn't surprise me. The guy's a freak." "You know Aaron Race?" I asked. "Better than his mama," Daisy said with a leer. "What I don't know about his finances and business ain't worth blowing your nose on. He's a savvy businessman with a knack for making money." "What makes you call him a freak, then?" I asked. Daisy stopped tapping to look at me as if she'd forgotten I was standing there. For a moment, I thought she would refuse to tell me anything. But then she said, "The way he deals with all the money he makes, for instance, is like he doesn't give a shit about it." "What do you mean?" Harrison asked. "He routes most of it to causes all over the world," Daisy said. Harrison looked so disappointed. I knew he had expected to hear that Race Incorporated were drug or arms dealers. "He runs a charity," he said. Daisy seemed to take this as a personal criticism. "I'm not talking about the company, boyo. I'm talking about his personal fortune. He gives thousands away to noble causes," she snarled. "Leprosy Society, Mother Teresa's Helpers, Starlight Foundation. It's like he's a giveaholic, because dig a little deeper and you find his giving ain't quite so discriminating. For instance, he donates to the IRA, Taliban, and a dozen different religious cults with more than a nodding acquaintance with terrorism." "Race Incorporated sends money to terrorists?" I asked, totally confused. Daisy glared at me. "You got wax in your ears, kid. The guy is funding everything.
radical communist organizations, radical socialist organizations, anarchist leagues and neo-fascist groups, Ku Klux Klan and black activist organizations, gun support groups and fanatical anti-gun organizations. It's like he's funding both sides of just about every odd cause you can imagine. And quite a bit of racist company donations also wind its way to some pretty offbeat causes too. It's all here.
She got out a memory stick and set it on the table beside her cigarette packet.
Now, what about a drink?
Sure. What would you like? Harrison asked. Daisy smiled, and for a second she looked like someone's sweet old grandmother.
Now I wouldn't say no to one of Ruth's special Italian hot chocolates. You just toddle along and make it up, and I'll put what I brought into Ruth's system.
He exchanged a look, then went out obediently. Somehow, I wasn't surprised to find a jug of the chocolate in the fridge with a note telling us to heat it in the microwave for Daisy. She came in as we were pouring the chocolate and prowled restlessly around the kitchen, picking up things and putting them down again. She came to the list of names we had been compiling and which I had brought in from the lounge and picked that up too.
I remember that guy.
She was pointing to an opera singer.
He was this fat bozo with greasy hair and a voice like an angel. Just hearing him made you want to wrap yourself around him, at least until he stopped singing.
She cackled, and I hoped I didn't look as shocked as I felt.
He went on and made the big time. Then he just went crazy and started singing these operas written by a mad woman. People went in the beginning because of him, but the reviews stank. Ended up in an asylum, he did.
Harrison handed her the chocolate, and she slurped it up with the noisy relish of a little kid, before leaving without so much as a goodbye. "So that was Daisy," I said, when Harrison came back from escorting her to the front door. We both laughed. Then the phone rang. Harrison answered it while I washed the cup and pot, wondering what it meant that Aaron Race funded so many causes. Then Harrison came back, and I turned to ask him. But his face was white as chalk, and his eyes were like bruises.
"What is it?"
I whispered, frightened.
"That was Raoul. He's calling from Bellevue. It's Sari," he said, his eyes filling with tears.
"Harrison, what?" I took a step towards him.
"Alison, she's killed herself."
39. I didn't get home until almost 4 in the morning, and even then I didn't seem to be capable of putting one thought together with another. Raoul had returned at 2 o'clock, looking drawn and exhausted. I made hot tea for him, suppressing a little stab of horror at seeing the blood on his collar.
"What happened?"
Harrison asked, when Raoul had a cup of tea in his hand. Raoul sighed.
"I hadn't long arrived at Bellevue. I was just speaking with a receptionist when one of the nurses came rushing along the hall, shouting that Sari had cut her wrists. She was young and frightened, or she wouldn't have blurted it out like that. There would have been a code she should have used, so she didn't alarm any civilians. As it was, I insisted on coming with them, and short of summoning a male nurse to physically restrain me, there was nothing they could do." He gave a weary laugh, and it seemed impossible that he could laugh at such a time before deciding that he must be suffering from shock.
"It was Austin, wasn't it? How did he get to her?"
Harrison demanded through gritted teeth. Raoul blinked at him, eyes red-rimmed with fatigue.
"I don't know why I didn't have the sense to phone Sari from here before I left, to warn her and tell her I was on the way. As it was, Austin arrived about 20 minutes before me and bullied the matron into shifting Sari to a small room where he could examine her. He was smart enough not to let her see him until they were alone. One of the younger nurses was passing and heard her scream. She ran in and found Dr. Austin trying to administer an injection. Sari was struggling and terrified.
"Bastard,"
Harrison grated. Dr. Austin ordered the nurse out, and if he had been in white she might have obeyed, but he wasn't, so she told him to leave Sari alone, Raoul went on. When he didn't, she knocked the syringe from his hand. Then she rang for help, and minutes later the matron appeared and hustled Dr. Austin out into the hall. He was shouting that Sari had been removed from his care without the proper authority, and that he had merely been trying to administer a tranquilizer. The young nurse had been left to calm Sari, who started babbling that Dr. Austin was one of them, that she'd felt the wrongness in him. The nurse ran out to tell the matron that the upset had brought on an episode.
Sari would have been alone for all of 5 minutes, and that's when she did it. She used a scalpel out of the sterilizing machine.
"I cannot believe this has happened," Harrison exclaimed, his eyes blazing. "What was he trained to do?"
"Drug her strongly enough to let the sickness take over, I'd guess. But he somehow let her feel or see that he was infected. I'm sure he thought Sari wouldn't fight. Or it might be that the sickness was driving him so hard he didn't think. Frankly, he looked a mess. His clothes were obviously thrown on without any regard for how he looked, and he was unshaven, his hair wild. If he hadn't had his ID with him, I doubt he'd have been let in at all. I barely took in what he was saying. The tragedy of Sari's life and death was like some terrible shadow that had crept inside me. I kept thinking of her, licking the ice cream and talking about going with the flow. Kept feeling it was my fault, because she would not have been in hospital if not for me. But Raoul was talking again. By the time I got there with the nurse and the receptionist, Austin was ranting that they'd killed his patient. I said that I thought we should call the police. And just like that, all the bluster went out of him. I was careful not to say who I was, and Austin assumed I was connected to the hospital. He said we'd all be sorry for our interference. Then he left. After he had gone, the matron let me go in and see Sari. I took a deep breath. They had bandaged her wrists to stop the blood, but there was so much of it over her.
"He spoke to her before she died?" Harrison asked in a wretched voice.
Raoul looked at him blankly.
"Died? What are you talking about? I just told you they bound her wrists, and a little later, when the doctor finally arrived, they gave her a transfusion."
"But are you saying she's not dead?" Harrison jumped to his feet in agitation. Raoul looked at him, and then at me, in dawning horror.
"Oh, God, don't tell me you've both spent all these hours thinking she was dead."
"You told Harrison she killed herself."
"No, Alison, I said Sari had cut her wrists. But of course that's what Harrison would think. Oh, what a fool I am. It was just so confused there. And when I spoke to you, Sari was in the process of having a transfusion. I don't even know why I called, really, except that I wanted to tell someone else who cared about her."
"Sari's alive," I whispered, wanting to hear the words again and again. Then Harrison was demanding to hear the whole story from the beginning, because like me, the fact of Sari's death had been all that mattered when we had heard the story first. Raoul obliged, and Harrison and I interrupted constantly, and in the middle of it, we realized that we were all ravenous, so we phoned a 24-hour pizza place. Given the circumstances, we ought to have been grim, but the news that Sari had not died after we spent hours mourning her was such an incredible relief that Harrison and I were elated, and Raoul ended up the same. Later, when the pizza had arrived, and we were eating it in hot slabs straight from the box, Raoul said, "I stayed because I wanted to speak with Sari before I left. She'd fainted from loss of blood and shock, and the transfusion took place while she was still unconscious. The doctor arrived while this was happening, and she was aghast. The nurse who had saved Sari found an unbroken ampoule that Austin had left behind, and she means to send it off to be tested. I'll be very interested to hear the results." Sari awoke very groggy and confused, but when the nurse tried to administer a sedative, Sari begged not to be drugged. Not even the usual small dose. Dr. Abernathy agreed not to administer the sedative, but she insisted Sari rest, so I was only given a few minutes with her. He paused to take a drink, and Harrison and I waited expectantly, because we had not heard this part of the story. She looked so small and frail, and utterly exhausted, but very calm. I don't think I've ever seen her look so calm. I told her that I was sorry I hadn't got there sooner, and she said, still with this calmness, that she would rather be dead than devoured by the wrongness inside her. I asked if that was why she had cut her wrists. She said that she hadn't been able to think of anything else to do to make them not drug her, and that if Dr. Austin had drugged her, she would have been helpless, because the sickness was very strong now. Ironically, that poor little nurse who saved her from Austin probably ended up pushing her the final inch, because Sari thought, when she talked of getting the doctor, she meant Dr. Austin.
I can't believe he did this, Harrison said. He must know he stepped over the line, legally as well as ethically.
I doubt he is capable of caring. At the hospital, he looked half deranged. And on the drive back, it occurred to me that the sickness of spirit might erode logic and reason when it goes far enough.
I was bothered by this conclusion. Aaron Race must be a lot further gone, if we're right about him, but he doesn't strike me as anything but cool and calculating.
I was thinking about that too, Raoul said.
I'm wondering if Aaron Race isn't some sort of anomaly. It seems to me that the end result of the sickness would usually be a sort of complete mental disintegration, a hollowing out that leaves a human shell. But in Race's case, the wrongness is able to go on operating after it has travelled its usual course.
I shivered. Raoul sounded so certain, so convinced of his theories. But the truth was, we knew frighteningly little of the sickness and what it would do to its victims. "Do you think Austin'll try to get to Sari again?" I asked.
Only a fool would attempt it after what happened. But tonight has shown how ruthless those affected by the sickness can be, and how determined. But Sari will be safe, because I've hired security for her. He'll be there by now.
"Surely Dr. Austin will be charged for what he tried to do," Harrison protested.
Raoul frowned. "I'd like to say yes. Dr. Abernathy struck me as a strongly ethical woman. But I think the medical profession has always been a bit of an old boys' club, and they would far rather deal internally with their dirty linen."
"It should be in jail," Harrison said.
Raoul asked about Daisy. He sounded hoarse, and he was beginning to look exhausted. So after Harrison told him what Daisy had said, I suggested we ought to go. Raoul asked if we'd mind if he sent us home in a taxi, then called one.
As we waited for it, Harrison wondered again why Race would fund so many disparate groups, and Raoul said it was almost certainly just another way to sow despair and pain and discord. Once we anonymously released his weird financial dealings to the media, he would go from influential friend of the stars to persona non grata. His charity, too, would fall from grace.
"He will still be what he is, but his power to cause harm will be weakened," Raoul concluded.
"But not stopped," Harrison said grimly.
Raoul didn't take that up. He agreed that we should use Gary Solomon, but said the journalist had to make absolutely certain that Aaron Race would not learn who had blackened his name, because if he did know who had destroyed him, he was likely to be utterly ruthless. I shivered. "You make it sound as if he would send someone to kill us."
Raoul gave me a level look. "After tonight, I think that someone infected by wrongness would not stop at murder."
Harrison and I sat in silence as the taxi bore us away from Raoul's church house. The gliding motion of the taxi and the flickering of streetlights against dark, silent streets soon lulled me to sleep. I dreamed that I was a wolf in the ruined city, only this time a dog was running beside me, a great white-furred beast, which, when I looked at it, nuzzled me on the cheek. I was startled to feel both its devotion and its desire, and my wolf self responded with a quickening of her own desire. The shock of this woke me with a start. Harrison was leaning over me.
You're home, he stammered.
Thanks, I said, touched that he had got the taxi to bring me all the way home first. Despite it being so late, Dar was up with Neil and Titch, and they were in the middle of reworking a song when I entered the kitchen. The song they were reshaping was one of my favourites, a lovely ballad full of wistful hope and gentleness, but what they were doing with it seemed jarring and uneven to me. When they had finished the run-through, Neil asked what I thought, and I wished he hadn't.
"I've always liked that song." My voice sounded scratchy with tiredness.
Dar sighed.
"So did I, which is maybe why I don't like this version."
"Why don't you leave it as it is?" I asked.
"I need a song that Neo Tokyo can play. I can just hear Aaron saying that it's slight compared with the big topics they usually tackle."
"Slight?" I almost shouted. "Why is it that people always think bad, dark things are more real and important than things that lift you up and make you feel life is worth living? You ought to tell them that in a song."
"Wow,"
Neil said. I felt silly then,
The Da surprisingly gave me a hug, and for a minute I was immersed in his essential gentleness and the coffee grounds and pine needle and rope smell of his essence. But I began, after a blissful few seconds, to feel other things. His worry about money, his concern for Serenity, and his inner dialogue about musical integrity. Rather than pulling away as the pressure of his thoughts began to press down on me, some instinct born of all that had happened that night made me hold him even more tightly, lay my cheek against his, and use the only weapon I had against the yammering of his doubts and worries, my love for him, and the lovely radiant memory of the Urban Dingo concert. When I let go, Da looked slightly dazed.
"Alizon, what did you—"
I cut him off, not sure myself of what I had done. "I think what you and the guys do with your songs and music is really important, because it's an antidote to the despair coming from everyone else."
"Your Da couldn't have found better words, Alley Cat,"
Neil said. Da looked at me closely.
"Are you okay, Alizon?"
I remembered then that I had called him earlier to tell him about Sari and to explain I would not be home until later. "Oh, Da, I should have said at once. We misunderstood when Raoul called about Sari. He said she'd cut her wrists, and we thought she was dead, but she wasn't."
"How is she, then?"
Da asked. "She's had a blood transfusion, and she's sleeping peacefully."
"Why'd she do it?" Neil asked, sounding baffled. "A kid your age," Da said.
"She's had a much harder life than I have, Neil. Her mum died when she was really little, and she doesn't have any brothers or sisters. She's been alone since she was about 5.
"Poor kid," Titch said.
My eyes burned, my throat ached, and I felt I could sleep for centuries and still be tired.
"You look all done in, Alley Cat," Da said gently. "Go to bed. We'll talk in the morning."
I stumbled upstairs, took off my outer clothes, crawled under the bedding, and was asleep almost at once. I woke what seemed like 5 minutes later, my head aching fit to burst. I staggered to the bathroom, certain this was the result of whatever I had done to Da. I dry swallowed a couple of headache pills, splashed water on my face, and brushed my teeth, the events of the previous night surging through my mind. I went to the bedroom and was startled to see that it was lunchtime. Serenity was sitting up on her bed, dressed and holding a notebook on her lap. She looked calm, and although she smelled of licorice as strongly as ever, there were no petrol or burning hair smells. Before I could think what to say to her, there was a brief rap at the door. Jesse poked his head in to say Mum wanted to know if Serenity was ready to sit. Serenity rose and all but glided out, the same blankness in her expression. I went downstairs to find Da on the verge of leaving to rehearse with Neo Tokyo. There was none of the weariness I had seen in his face when I came home the night before, and to my delight, the air around him was bending outwards as powerfully as it used to do. There were even a few sparks. "You seem happy," I said.
"Inspired is the word you want, Alley Cat, and you can blame yourself for it. What you said last night?"
"What I said," I echoed. My memory of my arrival at home in the early hours of morning was blurred with exhaustion. Da grinned.
"You said that lifting people's spirits wasn't anything to do with being happy or sad. What was important was to lift people up so that for a little while they could get a clear view."
"I said that?" He laughed.
"Maybe I jazzed it up a little, or maybe your words sparked it. And that's what I ended up writing a song about. I wish I had time to play it through for you, but I've got to get traveling. Not much rehearsal time before it has its day in the sun."
"You seem okay about playing with other people now," I said. Da shrugged.
"It felt like the integrity of my music was the same as my loyalty to losing the rope. Then, a couple of nights ago, Neil tells me I'm a fool to think it, that music doesn't belong to anyone once it's made, and that no musician belongs to a single band. He reckons that if Race Incorporated wants me to play solo or Neo Tokyo wants me to do this function, then why not? After all, losing the rope can still play together and we'll continue to write our songs. Neil says he's over-gigging around anyway, and Titch was never that much into it in the first place. Then, last night writing this song with them for me to play with Neo Tokyo,
I realized there was something exciting and invigorating in mixing it up with other people and other styles. And of course, music and songs are ageless and timeless when they're really saying something important. He glanced at his watch and began to pull on his battered bomber jacket. Watching him, I felt that the sunshine slanting in the window